this week on the Best of Flashpoints. Analysis from Ali Abu Nima as the Palestinian death toll tops 1,000, including 300 children, with nearly 5,000 more wounded. Nora Barrows-Friedman interviews leading Palestinian legal scholar and attorney Diana Bhutto in Ramallah. We'll hear from international legal scholar Richard Falk, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights for Illegally Occupied Palestine, on what he's calling a new kind of Israeli war crime, and JR and the Block Report on the arrest of Bay Area killer subway cop, Johan Mescherli. Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and JR are coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our coverage of the Israeli carnage supported by U.S. weaponry and tax dollars of the Gaza Strip, which has turned into a 20-mile-plus massacre. And joining us is Ali Abu Nima of the electronicintifada.net. Ali, of course, it's very difficult to get information, and the Israelis purposely control and shut down the flow so that they can decide who's going to learn what when. But before we get into the politics here, you've been monitoring Al Jazeera and calling your own sources. Give us your estimate, your analysis of how you see the situation now.
Well, in terms of victims of these atrocities, ongoing massacres and atrocities, there's now more than 1,000 Palestinians dead, more than 315 of them children, more than 100 women, and the remaining men, the vast majority of them also are civilians. The number of injured is approaching 5,000. These are many of them horrific injuries, people suffering severe burns all over their bodies due to the use of white phosphorus and other kinds of horrific ammunition by Israel. Many people have lost legs, they've lost limbs, they've lost their eyesight. These are injuries that will be with them for the rest of their lives. On top of that, they have lost family members, they've lost homes. Many people are dying because they cannot get medical care because of the Israeli blockade and the ongoing bombardment. It's notable that in the Arabic media, many people are using the term Holocaust quite freely to describe what is going on. The word mahraqa in Arabic does mean burning, a great burning, and that seems to be what's going on in Gaza. Entire families are being incinerated in the ongoing Israeli assault.
All right. We saw hearings yesterday for the new Secretary of State floated through easily, and it was sort of like an 8 to 10 hour cheerleading session for Hillary Clinton, in which she repeatedly talked about how Israel has the right to defend itself and that the entirety, in essence, of the blame for all these dead Palestinians is Hamas's fault.
So many lies, Dennis. So many lies have been told by the Bush administration. So many lies are being told by the incoming Obama administration and its supporters. Of course, as your listeners know, Hamas didn't start this. Israel started it when it violated the ceasefire on November 4th. Israel started it by its silent warfare of siege and famine, deliberately induced famine against the people of Gaza, the ongoing assassinations. And now what's going, I mean, there's no way to say that what Israel is doing is self-defense. By no stretch of the imagination, you have to be an idiot or simply someone who is so enslaved to pro-Israel propaganda that you cannot think for yourself. There's just no way that this is self-defense. And what's going on now is that basically on the ground, Israel has failed to achieve what it wanted to do, which was to break the will of Palestinians, to break the resistance, and to get people turned against Hamas. And because they failed to do that, they're just continuing the killing and the bombing because they don't want to stop and let the world see that they failed once again as they did in Lebanon. So they're hoping that, like in 2006, the world will rush to their rescue with a ceasefire plan that gives Israel what it couldn't achieve with violence, which is to disarm Palestinian resistance and to basically get Palestinian cooperation with this horrific occupation regime. That is why people are dying now, is to save Israel's face.
Ali, there's a story that keeps coming up around this, and I guess I wanted to get your response about a offshore gas deal with British gas and British corporations working with Israel. These are natural gas reserves right off the Gaza Strip that could give the Palestinians hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in revenue. And yet it appears that Israel, with the help of Tony Blair, who's supposedly working with the quartet for peace, but is also manipulating this deal from Egypt to Israel. Do we see that there's a corporate side of this as well?
Well, the British gas and the natural gas reserves which lie in Gaza's waters have been a story for some time. What Israel doesn't want is for Palestinians to have any kind of independence, including economic independence and resources. And another element of that is that you have the collaborator regime in Ramallah, the so-called Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, and its former president, Mahmoud Abbas, whose term expired on Friday, on January 9th, who, since Hamas won the elections, have also been collaborating with Israel to make sure that Hamas, as the elected party, doesn't get its hands on these resources. So you have a multi-pronged effort, including Israel, including the so-called Palestinian Authority, and British gas to keep those resources from the Palestinian people. I don't know that that is certainly part of Israel's long-term warfare against Gaza, but I don't know that it's a factor in this specific set of atrocities and massacres.
And final minute on Obama, the inauguration, great celebration, a new day in Washington. I guess it's not a new day for the Palestinians.
No, it's very much more of the same. I certainly have nothing to celebrate. For me, January 20th is just another day. There's no sign that it's going to be any change at all in Bush's Middle East policies, and that's a real tragedy. I think people wanted real change. I think many people were conned into thinking they were going to get change. But on January 21st, we're going to be singing the same deadly tune from the United States while Palestinians, Iraqis, Afghans, and others die for being on the wrong end of American-made, American-supplied bombs.
All right, Ali Abunima, not good news, but it's always important to get the information. I recommend, if people are interested in an alternative flow of information on this devastating story for Palestinians, the electronicintifada.net is a terrific place to get that information. And Ali, you've been doing a great job putting it out. So thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
Your mind lies in the devil's workshop. Evil doing's your thrill. And trouble and mischief is all you live for. You know done well, and that you go to hell. You go to hell. So you live in high.
And you're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Next, we'll hear from Nora Barrows-Friedman, Flashpoint's senior producer, on special assignment in the occupied West Bank. Here's Nora.
I'm here with Diana Bhutu. She is a human rights lawyer and former negotiator with the PLO and an international law expert here in occupied Palestine. Diana, thank you so much for being here again.
Thank you, Nora. Thanks for having me.
And so we want to talk about the violations of international law first that are happening inside Gaza. We see the targeting of an occupied and entrapped civilian population. We see the Red Cross and the Red Crescent and all sorts of different paramedic units being targeted. And then there are the so-called unconventional weapons that are being used. Can you kind of give us a litany of all the war crimes that are being perpetrated at this moment in Gaza?
I don't know if I can give you an entire list because it's not clear about everything Israel's doing, because as you've said, not only has the Red Cross not been able to functionally operate inside the Gaza Strip, but also other human rights organizations, including the press as well, have been barred from entering Gaza. So what we're getting is simply a sampling of the war crimes that are being committed. But the first thing to start off with is that what Israel's doing is itself a war crime. Israel's claiming that this is being done in self-defense, but Israel cannot use the defense of self-defense when it is an occupier. This is something that has been stated very clearly in international law. And so the idea that somehow Israel is allowed to use this type of weaponry, whether it's simple weaponry or even the now banned weaponry, all of it is illegal under international law. And so that's the first thing. It cannot use the defense of self-defense. And given that it cannot use the defense of self-defense, there is no room and no need to discuss the issue of whether Israel's response, if it is a response, is proportional. What it is doing is simply illegal. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Israel has been categorically denying humanitarian supplies to the people of the Gaza Strip, whether it's adequate water, fuel supplies, electricity supplies, food supplies. This has now not just been going on for the past 17 days of Israel's bombardment, but also over the course of the past 3 years. So this is, again, is a war crime. Under the international, under the Geneva Conventions, Israel's required not to bombard the Palestinians, but it's actually supposed to be protecting the Palestinians. And so the fact that they're going to great lengths to bar human rights organizations and humanitarian supplies into the Gaza Strip is itself a violation of international law and is a war crime. The third major problem is that Israel has completely sealed off the Gaza Strip. People are not being allowed to flee. They're not being allowed to go into safe areas. And so, again, Israel is violating its right to actually protect the civilian population. And the fourth thing is the demolition and destruction of infrastructure. Israel is supposed to be, under the Fourth Geneva Convention, not demolishing Palestinian infrastructure, but is actually supposed to be preserving Palestinian infrastructure. And so the fact that we've seen such gross and mass destruction of government buildings, water facilities, water sewage facilities, is itself also violations of international law. And finally, it's the use of Israel's weaponry. What we're now hearing is that Israel's using phosphorus bombs that it's dropping. There are other people saying that Israel's using dime bombs on the Palestinian population. Apart from the fact that we hear denials from the very party that is actually killing Palestinians, we have no way of actually verifying what Israel's doing. And so we've been calling for Israel to open up the borders. If it is so concerned with these allegations, prove that they are wrong rather than simply making the allegation that they are wrong.
Can you talk a little bit more about the dime bombs and what you know about them?
What I have been told is that these are bombs that when they enter into a human skin, they actually burrow their way into skin and end up leading to massive hemorrhaging within the body, to the point where people don't actually realize that they are hemorrhaging. Similarly, the phosphorus bombs, what we've been told and what we're hearing reports of in the Gaza Strip is that people are reporting a strong burning sensation. Children have gone blind from this. And you can see with some of the people who have felt this, that they are all reporting the same sort of extensive and very harsh burning into the skin.
That's the voice of Diana Boutu. We're here in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Diana, what can you say about the legalities of barring international and domestic press from the Gaza Strip?
Well, this is Israel learned a lesson. It learned a lesson from what it did in Lebanon in 2006 and in its previous assaults on the Palestinian people, whether it was in 1982 in Sabra and Shatila or later. What happens is that if press is allowed there, then they will report on what Israel is doing. And so what they've done is they've made a very calculated decision. This is why I believe that this was not a question of Israel responding to Hamas, but this was a very premeditated act on their part. What they had done earlier was that press had been allowed in for a certain period of time, but what they did was that they made it so erratic, so such that foreign press did not want to go down to Gaza. They were afraid that they would be trapped there for days, perhaps weeks on end. They knew that there would be no foreign press in the Gaza Strip during this period. And indeed, now all that we see in the Gaza Strip is, in terms of foreign press, are Palestinian journalists who are affiliated with Associated Press and with Reuters, or Al Jazeera International. And so it's not at all surprising. Now, the Supreme Court said that once humanitarian supplies are allowed into the Gaza Strip, so too the international press should be allowed to enter into the Gaza Strip. The army has ignored the court's ruling, and hence we see that we've got a whole bunch of foreign journalists who are stationed on the Gaza-Israel border watching the war from afar, rather than actually inside the Gaza Strip watching the assault and feeling the assault.
Deanna, as someone who has studied and researched international law and human rights law, and as a Palestinian who is watching the carnage unfold on TV every night, especially these images of children just being completely shredded, what goes through your mind personally, and then as a lawyer, as a human rights expert?
Helplessness. I feel helpless. I feel hopeless. I feel angry. Just the whole range of betrayed. You know, and then I sort of step back as a lawyer and think, well, what can be done? And this is where I get even more angry. The problem with the international legal system is that it is based on state to state. So if you are a state, you can make a claim against another state. Palestinians are stateless. They are attacking a civilian population. They are not attacking another state. And so as such, it's going to be very difficult for the Palestinians to bring forward cases of war crimes against Israel. We either have to wait for the mercy of the International Court of Justice through a UN resolution that will bring it to the International Court of Justice, or we have to wait for the mercy of a nice European state, whether it's Belgium or Spain or wherever it is, to be able to bring forward these charges of war crimes. My anger, my betrayal, my helplessness, my hopelessness is magnified by the fact that the international legal system does very little for the Palestinians, and by the fact that the international community of states is doing absolutely nothing for the Palestinians.
And here in the occupied West Bank, separated physically, geographically from Gaza, people are talking about the second occupation of the Palestinian Authority right now, who are kind of subcontracting the Israeli occupation and suppressing resistance, suppressing protests all across the West Bank. It kind of illustrate for us what's going on in terms of the Fatah leadership, the PA, and what's going on the streets.
Well, we're actually in an interesting time now. President Abbas's term expired on January the 9th. So we have a president who has now illegally extended his term. We have a prime minister who had never gotten the approval of parliament in the first place, who's also illegally extended his term. But it's not just the illegal extension of their terms, it's what they are doing on the ground now. For the first 13 days, the prime minister, again, a man who didn't get parliamentary approval, remained silent. He didn't come out, he didn't condemn Israel's actions. He chose the approach of simply doing nothing. 13 days later, he decided to appear. And now what Saddam Fayyad is trying to do is trying to capitalize on this growing sentiment, growing anger, and trying to demonstrate that he is a man of the people, that he is a person who supports Gaza. He's never supported Gaza. He, in fact, some of his policies were the very policies that ended up leading to the closure of Gaza. He's coming out now daily with press releases and statements. It's all too little, much too late. And Palestinians see past this. When it comes to President Abbas, not only did he come out and tacitly blame Hamas for Israel's bombardment of the Palestinians, he's blamed the victim. He's done absolutely nothing to get Hamas's support to actually represent the Palestinian people. And instead, what he's been doing is he spent his entire time simply traveling. That's just one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that we see what is actually happening on the streets. Palestinians are angry, just as people around the world are angry. When I turn on the TV and I see 100,000 people marching in London, And I don't see 100,000 people marching in Ramallah. You have to ask yourself, why is that? And there is a reason. The Fayyad government has first attempted to ban protest. Then when protests did start taking place, they banned the Hamas flag. So even if you were holding up the Hamas flag and the Fatah flag as a means of trying to show national unity, you were instantly arrested. If you chant Hamas slogans during protests, you were automatically arrested. And just last week alone, on Friday, they not only sent in thugs to beat up women and children who were supporting, but they pepper sprayed these women, barred journalists from filming the pepper spraying of women, sent in female police officers who have been trained, incidentally, in Jordan and in Egypt to beat up these women protesters. And so basically what they're doing is they're sending a message that you are not allowed to protest, that the only way that you can express yourself is if you stand 100% firmly behind the failed policies of President Abbas. If you do that, then you're okay. And if you in any way challenge, then you will be arrested. In fact, the foreign minister slash information minister, who incidentally has done a terrible job at getting the Palestinian voice out there, he came out the first few days of the Israeli assault on Gaza and said that nobody will be able to challenge the legitimacy of the Palestinian Authority. And that, in effect, sums it up, that mild protests, small protests are allowed, but only small and limited where there's no freedom of expression allowed.
And there were supposed to be elections a few days ago, but those have been postponed. Because of growing solidarity and sympathy with what's happening in Gaza and to the Hamas party, possibly, do you think that Fatah may be on its way out in terms of governing the Palestinian Authority?
It's hard. It's difficult to predict anything. I don't think that they ever want to have elections. And in fact, now you hear senior people within the party saying that they don't want to have elections. They haven't cleaned up their own act internally. They don't have a head of Fatah or a deputy head of Fatah. The party's a mess. More importantly, they made it very clear, even prior to Israel's assault on Gaza, that they weren't going to hold presidential elections. And so what they're basically, in effect, saying is that there won't be any elections anytime soon. They're simply going to ensure that Palestinians don't have a right to vote. And this is one of the problems, is that rather than Fatah cleaning itself up, trying to demonstrate to the Palestinian people that they actually have a vision and a strategy to end Israel's occupation, other than simply co-opting itself into doing whatever Israel and the United States wants it to do, they're simply going to resign themselves to doing nothing, and in the hope that doing, and in the firm belief that doing nothing is going to get the Palestinians anywhere, and we all know that it won't.
And finally, in about a week, the United States will have a new administration. People are saying that Israel is doing this right now because they're sure that Obama is going to end the occupation and that he's going to end the siege on Gaza. But there are others who are skeptical of that. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I don't at all hold myself to any illusions that Obama is going to do a whole lot for Palestine other than what perhaps Clinton had done. I feel that he's going to be middle of the road between a Clinton presidency and between a Bush presidency. But given the disastrous effects of the past 8 years, many people will blindly look at that as being an improvement, but it is not. I think that the reason that Israel did this was not so much because they fear what Obama is going to do, but quite the opposite, to raise the bar so that Obama can then no longer challenge what Israel is doing. So whether it is attacking Iran in the coming months or in the coming years, or whether it is doing more of the same to the Palestinians, the bar has been set, and what Israel's done is it's lifted the bar. I don't think that an Obama presidency is going to somehow curtail Israel, particularly after the bar has been set so high. But instead, I think it's going to simply allow Israel to do more of the same.
Thank you, Deanna.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Say I'm loud.
Tim Clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we're honored now to be joined by the honorable professor from Princeton. We're talking about Richard Falk. He is currently the UN special reporter on human rights in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. He attempted actually to get in to Israel last month and was prevented. Professor Falk, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and let me begin this way. Please assess, from your information, from the sources that you have, how would you characterize very specifically the impact of the current air, land, and sea war on the people of the Gaza Strip?
I think that one needs to recognize that this is a devastating series of attacks on a civilian population that was already gradually weakened by 18 months of blockade that restricted the entry of food, medicine, and fuel in such a way that international civil servants on the ground in Gaza and journalists were anticipating the possible collapse of Gazan society. So it's important to recognize that these attacks came on top of this prior situation that had already driven the civilian society to the point of near desperation.
Now, there's a lot of things being said, not a lot of information in the United States through the mainstream press, but there's strong sentiment around the world that a move towards genocide, pre-genocide, this is an attempt at ethnic cleansing. So help us put that into context. Again, how do you see, are we close? Are we getting close to a humanitarian catastrophe, a war crime? How would you say that?
Well, I think it's important to be careful with the use of language here. In my view, it is already an unfolding humanitarian catastrophe. The legal implications of that situation are more complex. I think there is no doubt that the Israeli attacks since December 27th constitute massive violations of international humanitarian law and of the UN Charter that prohibits the non-defensive use of force. Whether these violations add up to crimes against humanity is something that needs to be validated by looking at the intentions behind the attacks and getting some evidence as to what the actual intentions were, which are probably quite different than the publicly proclaimed explanations of the attacks. And that's even more true in relation to genocide and ethnic cleansing. The International Court of Justice tried to assess the contention that there was genocide committed by Serbia in Bosnia in the 1990s. And even though there was a very plain pattern of ethnic cleansing from a political perspective and a moral perspective, the great majority of the court declined to conclude that there was genocide from a legal perspective, except in the narrow situation of the massacre at Srebrenica in 1995. So I think it's important, particularly given my UN role, that I not be understood as suggesting that genocide or ethnic cleansing are part of the established reality at the moment, however gruesome it is from moral and political perspectives.
You said today that it's irresponsible to exclude Hamas from the international participation in the UN, other arenas. The United States, Condoleezza Rice, George Bush, current president, hold Hamas accountable. The Senate, the Congress of the United States are considering a very condemning proposal, sentiment of the Congress against Hamas as the key, putting the key blame at their foot. What's your response?
Well, I'm as an American, I'm really sad about that kind of response that is so one-sided, so out of touch with the sentiments that exist on the part of morally concerned people throughout the world, really, and increasingly in this country as well. I think there's a tipping point that we're approaching that is turning this conflict over the future of Palestine into the most important symbolic issue for the world since the anti-apartheid struggle of the 1980s. And for the United States government, at least, to be so out of touch with that is a rather alarming exposure of the degree to which our policies are distorted by domestic pressure groups.
Now, in terms of the role of Hamas?
Well, yes. I mean, that's one expression of I think, dysfunctional character of U.S. diplomacy is not to treat Hamas as a political actor, however regrettable some of its past policies may have been. It is the effective governmental authority in Gaza. Its representatives were elected in a free election backed by the United States in January of 2006. And if one wants to resolve the conflict, Hamas has proposed solutions that seem to me to be in accord with international law and to be quite reasonable. They are proposing a mutual long-term ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, and a opening of the crossings that will enable the end of the blockade and a resumption of at least normal occupancy conditions that are already difficult because Gaza is an impoverished society at best.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Richard Falk from Princeton, who is now the UN Special Reporter on Human Rights in the Occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He attempted to get into Israel last month, but couldn't do so. I want to tap your legal expertise here again, talking about, we rarely hear in the U.S. press this word occupation or illegal occupation of Palestine. I want to ask you about the right to resist an illegal occupation and also the back and forth around disproportionate responses, the Hamas and their supporters firing rockets into Israel and the Israeli attacks, cutoff, invasion, so on and so forth?
Those are difficult questions, and I can just give partial answers to them. But there is a right of resistance against an unlawful, sustained occupation. It's been widely recognized in the West ever since World War II, when there was resistance in France and elsewhere in Europe to Nazi occupation, to German occupation at that time. And so the more difficult issues are, what are the limits of right of resistance? And here I support the view that it is never legally or morally permissible to deliberately target civilians as a instrument of resistance. So what constitutes legitimate tactics and targets of resistance is a difficult and complicated issue, but there really does exist a right of resistance on the part of the Palestinian people. The overall tactics that have been employed by Israel have one feature that has been not very well articulated in the media, and that is the entrapment of a civilian population in a war zone. The Gazans have been denied the option of becoming refugees, which is, of course, not a pleasant option to choose, but if you're seeking safety from a war zone that is threatening your life and the life of your family and children and so on, the refugee option is the least terrible option available to civilian societies, particularly in a place like Gaza where the density of population is so great and the area is so small. But Israel has closed the exit. I mean, it has basically locked the population into this war zone. And as far as I know, that hasn't really happened before in such a systematic way. And it probably should be considered a new kind of war crime.
Well, finally, part of the problem here and part of the work has to do with documenting what's happening and after it's over, what happened, and to put it into some context and to see if there are patterns that lead us to various conclusions. But you are not allowed in there. Now, you're a significant person to turn away. Bishop Desmond Tutu, who was one of the leaders you referred earlier to the anti-apartheid movement, was turned away. We did see the United Nations adopt significant words having to do with information as a human right. So what about the inability to document, to report, to be able to clearly, contemporaneously document what's going on? Is that a Where does that come into this?
My exclusion, I think, was part of a wider pattern that Israel has been pursuing in recent months of trying to obscure the actuality of the occupation of the West Bank and particularly of Gaza. And it was partly to send a message to the UN that it was not going to cooperate in exposing this reality, and it is reinforced by the severe restrictions on the entry of foreign journalists, the exclusion of those journalists during the current campaign, while giving them free access to any kind of damage resulting from rockets fired from Gaza, and the failure to let qualified Palestinians who have knowledge of the conditions in Gaza leave. So it is the pursuit of what I've called the politics of opaqueness, trying to make it as difficult as possible to get credible report on the actuality of suffering that the civilian population in Gaza has been enduring before the attacks of December 27th and even more dramatically since then.
What about the fact that the United States rushed for a great deal of weaponry that is now being used against Gaza? Does the United States play a role? Do they have a responsibility?
Yes, of course they have a responsibility. I mean, both a domestic legal responsibility, because the weaponry is supposed to be only used in a defensive mode, and then a political responsibility as a complicit actor that undoubtedly had advanced knowledge and lent approval to this campaign and has obstructed efforts at the United Nations and elsewhere to secure a effective ceasefire as immediately as possible. So the U.S. is unfortunately very much in the eyes of the world, and from a more disciplined legal perspective, very much engaged as a partner with Israel in conducting this Gaza campaign. And it's something I regret very much as an American, seeing my government engaged in such a such policies.
Well, they had to know when they were turning you away that you could present a real problem if they were getting ready to start a war.
Yes. I mean, it's hard always to speculate on what the Israeli motives are, because what is disclosed is probably not what is the actual explanation for the behavior, and I think that applies probably to my exclusion. One thing I didn't mention that I think is important is that if you look at this campaign, it's been claimed to be about making Israel secure against rocket fire. But the actuality is that for the period of 6 months prior to December 27th, not a single Israeli casualty had resulted from rocket fire. A ceasefire had been rather effectively in place, and Hamas had been prepared at all stages to extend that ceasefire up to 10 years. And so one has to assume that there were other motivations for this attack, which, according to knowledgeable strategic observers, had been planned for at least 3 months and probably 6 months. And one of these objectives is to use the rocket attacks as a pretext for destroying Hamas as a political actor and providing Gaza with the same kind of governance that exists in the West Bank under the authority of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. And finally, I think it's important to take account of the motivation of the Israeli Defense Forces. They're a very powerful military institutions, which were didn't disguise very much their interest in having the opportunity to show that they were still a preeminent and efficient military force, and overcome the impression that had been left that they had declined as a result of the failure of the military operations in the 2006 Lebanon War. So there are a lot of reasons for this campaign, but none of the serious explanations has to do with trying to protect Israelis from the rocket fire.
All right. Well, we thank you for spending this amount of time with us, Professor Richard Falk, now with the United Nations Special Reporting on Human Rights in the Occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Very important information. Helps us understand a lot from the legal side of this. And we, again, are very grateful. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Of course, for those that we have left, we're thankful, but we can't afford any more losses. Oh, no. Oh, my God. They're shooting us down one by one. Don't forget that. Because they are. Killing us one by one. Well, all I have to say is that those of us who know how to protect those of us that we love, stand by them and stay close to them. And I say that if there'd been a couple of more, a little closer to Dr. King, he wouldn't have got it. You know, really. Just a little closer to him. Stay there. Stay there. We can't afford any more losses. He had seen mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. always living with a threat. Dead ahead, come on, Sam. Folks, you gotta stop and think. Oh, we're almost to the brink. What will happen now that the king of love is dead?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Next up, JR and the Block Report return with a story on the arrest of BART killer cop Joannes Mechelen. JR is one of over 100 people who were arrested during a militant protest meant to force the police and the DA to take decisive action in response to this point-blank killing of an unarmed black man in Oakland in the first hours of 2009. Here's JR on the Block Report.
You're listening to another edition of the Block Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. Today we're going to be talking to Don Wiggins, the cousin of Oscar Grant, who was murdered New Year's Day by BART police officers at the Fruitvale BART station in East Oakland. Breaking news is that the BART officer who pulled the trigger, Johannes Mosurle, was recently arrested yesterday. Now that it has been 2 weeks after the Oscar Grant murder, how do you feel about this officer being indicted last night?
Well, I think that was the right thing to do. It took a little long to do it. I think it should have been done a little quicker. But, I guess the process is, as they say, the ball is rolling.
Do you think that this would have came about so quickly after they were paying no attention to it if there had not been a rebellion in the streets of Oakland?
No, I don't think. I think they probably would just threw it over the shoulder and let it be that, you know, because it took protesters to go down there, fed up, which wasn't right for them to destroy property. But I can understand their grief and their anger because this has been happening so long to so many people. And you brought it to my attention about the young man in L.A., which was, I never heard about it.
And yeah, Dante's story.
Yes, yes. And see, that goes to show you that this is happening everywhere. This is just not an isolated incident. This is going on everywhere. And it's time for people to stand up. It's time for the government to restructure its law enforcement and everything else, man, because it's a shame, man, because they got hand in all kinds of things out here on these streets. And it's scary because I'm a father. I have 14 kids, so it's very scary.
Don, do you feel like them arresting one out of an estimated approximately five police that were there to the fight that was supposedly they were called for on the BART, do you feel that them arresting one is sufficient due to the fact that if we had murdered a police officer on tape, everyone who was with us would have went down for accessory? How do you feel about them getting just one and not the rest of them?
Well, me personally, I think all six should be indicted because they tried to cover it up, which was, it's a conspiracy. And that's the only right thing to do. So, I mean, because the simple fact is they tried to cover it up. And it was a hush-hush thing.
No doubt.
Now, not only did they needed his statement, what was the other officer's statements? What did they write in their reports?
Right.
Okay. They never said nothing about any of the other officers.
No doubt. Let me ask you this. A number of protesters basically pushed the hand of city government, and including myself, I'm one of the protesters that was given a trumped up charge, a felony charge of arson.
Yeah.
Does the family support amnesty for the protesters that helped to push the hand of the city government that even led to this one indictment?
Well, you know, we don't want nobody to go to jail. Yes, and we push for amnesty. I mean, I can't speak for other family members, but I can speak strongly for the heads of the families.
What is it that you as the family want people to know? I know that this is going into basically the second week. What do you have to say? What is it that you guys want to say in terms of, you know, the people locally, but also the people nationally who are listening, and internationally?
Speaking from the father's side of the family, we just wanted to be peaceful. We want to handle this in a dignitary manner. We don't want no more looting, no more fires, no more destruction of people's property. We just want to have a peaceful protest, and let's get this all out in the air. No more violence, please, because they are ready for it. And that's all they need, just one person to spark a flame, and it's all bad.
Well, let me ask you, like, why is it that the family is so much for peace when Oscar Grant's life was taken violently by the police and by the system, and it was covered up? Why is it that you, Oscar Grant's mother, is pleading for peace when the people aren't being given peace? Why should we get a city peace?
Because you can't get anything solved by violence. Fighting violence would never solve anything.
Let me ask you this. This generation also is not the Martin Luther King generation where we're going to stand there and get bit by dogs either. So I'm saying the pacifism isn't an answer either in terms of youngsters that's in the street nowadays.
I understand where you're coming from, but you have to understand also where we're coming from. What we're coming from is that we're in a new generation. We have change. We have now the head of heads. This is a black man.
Right, a black man who hasn't responded to the Oscar Grant issue yet, even though it's a national phenomenon. But go ahead.
Well, only thing I can say is that, you know, about that issue, man, is that, you know, he has a lot on his plate also. Even though this is a national thing, I'm pretty sure that he has his eyes and ears on it, you know. But he has a lot of other things on his plate also. So we can only just take this one day at a time. And back to the peace. Now, that's the only thing that's going to console us. I mean, you know, keep us whole. Because violence will tear us apart as a family, as a neighborhood, as a community. Now, we want some change. We all got to work together.
You're right, but violence has already taken Oscar Grant from his mother, has taken him from his daughter. Now, I mean, I'm not just an advocate of innocent people's stuff being torn up, but at the same time, that stuff can be replaced. Oscar can never be replaced.
No, but tearing up and burning stuff up and destruction of property isn't going to bring him back either.
No, it's not, but it will make it a national issue so that the police can get in.
It won't make it no better. You understand what I'm saying? Only thing you can do is turn it worse.
Well, let me ask you this, because
we have a lot of other people that are innocent out there getting hurt, just like you got snatched up and slammed on the ground with a chump charge. Just think about somebody else that's innocent.
You're right, but it wasn't the people who arrested me. It was the same police that shot, you know, the Oakland police who arrested me and the bar police who shot Oscar. So I'm saying it's not the people that are being violent. Anyway, it's the system that's being violent. Most of the acts, if not all of the acts, were committed against what they're saying is property. I mean, most of the charges is trumped up. But even the charges that's not trumped up is being talked about people against property, not against people assaulting the police and all this and all that. So I'm just saying that to say, I think that is let me finish. Yeah, I think it's very interesting that the media is allowing the victims, the people that were in the streets rebelling to seem like we're the perpetrators of a crime when Oscar Grant was killed by a man with a uniform and a badge on that was a sworn-in police officer who is making a living off of taxpayers' money, period.
Well, we can't be responsible for his actions. See, hey, violence isn't going to solve this. That officer's actions, now he's answering to those actions. We were fortunate enough to have this captured on camera. picture speaks for itself. The video speaks for itself. So now that it's at a standpoint that the people have to get fed up and got them to notice that they need to do something about this. That's why they're trying to do something about it, because they don't want their town, they don't want their city tore up, and I don't want my city tore up either. Like I said before, I'm a father. I have kids go back and forth from school every day. Okay? That's innocent people getting hurt.
No,
and we won't be no better than the police if we go out and continue to act like fools.
I think that, you know, I'm going to just leave it at this, and this is going to be the last thing I'm going to say on the issue. But just like they can say that people can commit suicide by cop, by quote-unquote attacking a police officer, that's a form of committing suicide instead of it being homicide with the police shooting him. I think that the city's negligence is what led to this rebellion going down, you know. So it's not so much on the rebels as much as it is on the inaction of the DA, inaction of the bar police chief, inaction of the mayor to indict not just Yohannes, but all of the officers that were involved in this case, so that we can begin to seek justice for the Oscar Grant family and though and victims of police terrorism in general.
Yes, I agree with that 100%. All right, my brother.
All right, brother Don, let me just give you the last word, bro. What's the last thing you want to say to the people, man, and then we out?
Just thank justice, just thank love, peace. Think about King, think about Obama, think about the new changes, and go out there and have a peaceful rally and protest today.
You were just listening to the voice of Don Wiggins, the cousin of Oscar Grant, the 22-year-old unarmed black male that was executed New Year's morning on the Fruitvale BART platform while being restrained by police officers. We talked about the arrest of police officer Yohannes Masurle, who pulled the trigger. He was arrested last night in Nevada. And we also talked about the need for the rest of the officers involved to be brought up on charges. The POCC and the Block Report radio show demands are as follows. All the officers involved should be indicted. The charges should be dropped against the protesters. The city should pay for all damages caused by the rebellion due to their own negligence. BART police should be disarmed, and all police involved in shootings should be arrested and held without pay until the investigation has concluded. This is the Minister of Information, JR, signing off for www.blockreportradio.com. Until next time, we out.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music by Nina Simone, Go to Hell, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, and The King of Love is Dead. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.